listening to Women Who Change Tech, the podcast that gives you access to women who are contributing, inspiring, trailblazing, and disrupting the business of technology. We believe that when women inspire other women, amazing things happen. I'm your host, Allison Wade.
And I am your host, Jessie Sterenshuis, and we are connecting women around the world to share ideas that help us thrive and advance in our personal lives and in our careers.
Be sure to share this podcast with your friends, rate and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and help us bring Women Who Change Tech into the lives of more professionals.
Hold on to your seats as we give you a dose of inspiration from some of the most talented and creative women who are shifting the face of technology. Hey, Allison, what's going on? What have you been up to?
Hey, Jessie, good morning. I am great. I am busy working and also planning a little trip to take my daughter around the state to look at Florida colleges. It's that time in her life where we need to start making those trips. So
that's
what I'm in the middle of. What about you?
Are you excited, nervous? What do you think?
You know, I'm both excited and nervous. As a parent, we want everything just to be magically perfect for our children. And I'm in that sort of phase where she really doesn't know what she wants to do. And that's always okay with me because I know life unfolds, but I'm just trying to be that person that's completely supportive and letting her have her own journey, but also be a little directional in the fact that maybe we should actually start this process and get going.
Yes. Well, I'm sure it will work out and I will be happy to make you a mom of the year sash. Because I always have a beautiful one at home.
You wear it around the house and really annoy your children with it?
Yes, all the time.
Oh my God. Yes, I think you should make me one. I should just wear it and like be in the kitchen or like be in the living room with it. And then my kids will be like, what the heck is that?
What is that? Like, Jessie made it for me.
The Improv Effect awarded me.
Yeah.
Very important company, the Improv Effect awarded me. The mother of the year.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Yes, here you go. Perfect. Anytime, I'm here for you. So I am also doing something with my daughters. We're heading to Charleston. They have a competition, a gymnastics competition this weekend. So we're excited. We're going to make a little vacation out of it. And also I'll probably be like heavy panic, like hold my breath while they're on the beam kind of weekend, but we are looking forward to it. So it should be
watching your kids flip on a beam with their head literally inches above the beam is always terrifying.
Yes, it is. It is super terrifying. So should be fun and also a little bit nerve wracking. Other than that, good times. I'll be wearing my sash.
Mothers of the year.
Yeah, totally.
So I wanted to introduce everyone to Isabel Evans. She is a woman who is a storyteller. I first met Isabel when she delivered a keynote talk at Star East called Telling Our Testing Stories. Isabel walked onto the stage barefoot, dragging a scarf behind her and reciting poetry. I will never forget that moment. I thought, what is she doing? But it was truly mesmerizing, and it was also really important information that everybody could use. And it was one of the highest rated keynotes we've ever had at the Star Conferences. She's also been working with me on Women Who Test and has done some amazing things there. She's taught tutorials and classes on things like shift left, test user experience, influence diagrams, a new way of understanding testing, human factors for test automation, how people affect project success. Isabel is a teacher and she helps people learn how to effectively tell their stories and positively influence their peers, their companies, and their products. And she's one of the most authentic and kind people I know. So I just love working with Isabel. Welcome, Isabel. How are you today?
Allison, thank you for having me here. And I'm well, thank you very much. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good.
And how are you, Jessie?
I am doing good, Isabel. I was so excited to meet you earlier in 2018 at Star Canada. It was so nice. Allison had told me so much about you. And so getting to see you in person was a total blast.
Well, ditto. And it's like that sort of sense of nerves before you meet somebody new, and then you end up getting on really well with them and finding all the things in common, whereas perhaps before you meet somebody, you can only feel the differences. So it was a good coming together of minds, I think.
Totally. I would love to kind of hear about your background, how you got started in technology and software, so our listeners kind of know where it all began.
Right. Well, I think history is a good word for this because we are going back into the dim and distant past here. Let me think. So going back to the 1970s, because the world was quite different then in terms of what was available to a young woman in terms of jobs in a career. So at the point where I was at school in the 60s and the early 70s, there were certainly careers that weren't available to you if you were a woman. So certain sorts of diplomatic service careers, civil service, number of other things, being a doctor, we were warned against, all sorts of things that were either unavailable because you weren't allowed to do them or were considered unsuitable. And then there was a series of careers which were considered suitable if you were a woman, secretarial, nursing, teaching. And I remember I left school kind of not knowing what I wanted to do. And I could have gone to university at that point. And I dropped out from that and I went off and I did cleaning work and factory work and all sorts of other things which were not what people were expecting me to do. And then got quite bored.
How would you get bored doing laundry? That seems so strange.
It's just extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. The factory work was inspiring. I have to tell you, being on a production line is like the best job in the world, you can imagine.
Totally.
Because it's given me a perception which I've always held about how lucky I am. Because at the point where I left those jobs to go and try and get back into college, I had the opportunity to do that. I had the ability to do that. And there were people I were working with just wouldn't have ever had that chance for all sorts of different reasons. So
I think that's really true, Isabel. My son has a mentor currently that he's working with, and he flat out told him the other day, I think your first sort of paying job, because he's an intern at a biohacking lab, he said, first internship needs to be in the service industry. He said, I feel that that's what's wrong with the world. Is that they have a lot of people go into careers where they have never done those things. And so they have a lack of appreciation for that. And it's so true.
I think, absolutely. So I'm being a bit long-winded about this, aren't I? I'll try and speed up a little.
No, you're not at all.
No, it's fascinating. Fascinating.
So I was working at that point where I got from Lakeville. I was working as a cook in a private household. And actually the lady whose house it was, who was a titled lady, said to me, I think you could be doing something else. I think you need to be thinking carefully about what your life's about, which is quite surprising, really. So I went off to the local college and they put me through some tests to see what sort of course, what sort of career might be suitable. And at the end of that, it came out and said that the thing that I should apply for was electronic engineering. So they sent me along for an interview at that department. And the guy who interviewed me, who's one of the lecturers in that department for a degree in electronic engineering, said to me, intellectually, you're quite capable of doing this subject, but you'd be the only woman in the department. So I think you should go to computer science because that's a woman's subject.
Yeah.
And I think to me, that's very funny looking back in a number of different ways. First of all, that the perception now of programming is so different.
Right.
You get people saying, women can't program, women can't test, and the fight back against that. And you go back to the 1970s, people saying, that's girls' stuff. That's what women do. And so I went down to the computer science department and had an interview, indeed, with a woman lecturer. And indeed, it was, a roughly 50-50 split, men and women. A lot of the lecturers were women. A lot of the students were women. So I started doing a computer science degree. And so it wasn't something I'd wouldn't even have been available as an option at the point that I was leaving school. Yeah, it wasn't even something to be thought of, really. And the odd thing is that my maths at school was never very good, but there were aspects of the maths that we did in the computer science degree which somehow spoke to me much more, that I was much more able to do, that I hadn't come across before. So that was an interesting thing.
What was that, or why do you think that was?
Because in school, it's very much about arithmetic and algebra, which is one mm-hmm. set of skills. And on the computer science degree, it was much more about theory of computing and logic and those sorts mm-hmm. of areas. So those parts of the mathematics I could do. There was still stuff on, I'm going to call it arithmetical, but that sort of number work, which I still mm-hmm. wasn't good at. But the sort of conceptual areas I found interesting and I could work with. It was different.
Probably because you were applying them too.
I think it's partly the application. I think that's true. But I think it's also that it's a different type of concept. I think manipulating logic is different to manipulating numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Multidimensional matrices is different to being able to do algebra. It feels to me like there's a different sort of thing going on.
Right.
And that was not something that I encountered at school. So that's how I got into it. I did a computer science degree, which included some extended periods out working. It was a technical college rather than a university, so we had time out in industry programming. So I worked for a couple of different companies doing programming of different sorts. And
did you take a job afterwards immediately? Like, did you immediately find a job after you got out of school?
I did not, because I changed my mind. One of the things that we'd done on the degree course was a section on the sort of sociological effects of automation. And there was a lot of talk about that a lot of jobs were going to disappear. And people were saying things like, I remember somebody saying to me, in 20 years' time, that would be the 1990s, there will be no last people.
Oh, wow.
And I was just thinking, I cannot be part of this. This is people's lives. We can't just sort of gaily think, oh, we're going to automate everything and it's going to be fine. And of course, you know,
That's probably a good lesson learned, because we're saying that now about AI and what AI is going to do to the future. So it's sort of almost similar in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, my final year thesis was on artificial intelligence and machine learning, and about whether machine intelligence was actually possible, theoretically.
Right.
Examining all the work that was being done in AI at that stage. And I guess when you look at it, you can see now there's been some advances, but it's not so much that it's at a conceptually different level, it feels to me. It's more the volume of it and the volume of the processing power that you can apply that means you can do the processing of problems that you wouldn't have done before. But I think the same question about whether it's actually intelligence or not intelligence still applies.
Right. Absolutely. And that's interesting, because that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, is how much change have you seen, in particularly obviously in computer science, but also in software testing, over the time period that you've been involved? Or do you think things are sort of, it's similar problems with just a different face?
I think it's similar problems. And I also think we're going round in circles. So one of the conversations that those of us who've been around for a long time, a few decades, I keep having with different people around the industry is just saying, oh, wow, did you just see that post, that article, that talk? And it's saying X is the solution to this problem. And what it's doing is reintroducing something that we were doing in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels to me like the industry goes round in circles, or dips down and comes out again, takes practices on and then discards them. Whereas in fact...
Why do you think that is?
Because I think, you know, Liz Hatton always said, Prof. Les Hatton, he always said, actually, this is a fashion industry.
Yep, I was just going to say that. Everything old is new again, just like fashion. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's a fashion industry. So there's that element. I think there's also an element where people are impatient for a solution to problems. And so they want something and then they will apply it in a really absolute sort of way. So instead of saying, here's this and a little bit of it will be suitable in this particular circumstance, done this way, if we tailor it like this, they'll be looking for, oh, V model, and it says we do it like this and we have to do it exactly like that without applying any thought. Oh, no, that takes too long. Right, agile. We need to do agile and we need to do it like this and there's a set. Mm-hmm. That's how we're going to do it. And then, oh, hang on, that hasn't solved these problems. Oh, so we need to do this bit over there. Right, so we need some more project management. Oh, but that means we've introduced a manager. And it's like binge dieting, you know? It's like moving from one thing to another instead of going, well, actually, you know, these are really complicated problems we're dealing with. Yes. By and large, you know, all the time we're trying to solve new things and we don't really know what we're doing and we haven't been doing it in the context of the human race for very long.
Yes.
It's going to take a long time and we just need to think about all the different elements of what we're doing and be quite holistic about it. And we can't simply say, oh, we're going to solve this little bit here and then we've done our job.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm making sense.
Do you think this is like that we were talking, well, in your talk at Star Canada, you talked about animal behavior. Do you think this kind of goes back to animal behavior and why we kind of go around in circles, that this has something to do with that, perhaps?
You know what? That talk, I talk about teams and leaders and followership. But actually, there is some stuff there in animal behavior about habit. So if you look at something like a water vole, it learns a route and it goes round and round in circles on that route, round its territory. Mm-hmm. If you change anything in the territory, it's usually had some sort of appalling accident before it's noticed the change because it's trying to do everything so quickly. Mm-hmm. So that there are some habit things like that that I think are quite true. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, there's some things there about how people behave around their intellectual stances, which is quite territorial.
Yep.
Yes, I think that's happening a lot in politics right now, right?
Yeah.
That territorialness is coming out and also that need to have a simple answer for everything and the fact not wanting to deal with the fact that life is complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I was talking to a friend the other day who works researching around things like climate change and various different environmental issues. And he was saying this, you know, there's such a lot of analysis to be done to understand what's going on. People want quick answers and they want quick answers to the sort of yes, no, is climate change a problem? And they want quick answers to the what do we do about it? And furthermore, answers that don't make them uncomfortable. And I said to him, you know, I'm finding the same in IT, that people are constantly talking about quick wins and low-hanging fruit and you're just thinking, well, you've got a great big infrastructure there. We need to look at the whole of that, the complexity of it. We need to think about it in a very broad way. I mean, I used the word holistic earlier, and I think that it's important that we realise that things are complicated, things are complex, we don't understand them.
Yeah, I agree, definitely. It has become, people just want a little prescription, right? A little prescriptive answer. Yeah. We find that at the conferences as well, too. We try to tell people, and I know you've done this, and I want you to talk about your role as a program chair. I know we think about this a lot in the program chair role. How are we going to make this presentations interesting? But what you want people more to do is to think about what they're learning, not just learn something and sort of say, oh, this is the new thing, this is the new thing. Really take a look at everything that's being presented and choose the parts that work for you, because that's really how we forge new paths and get things done.
Yes. Absolutely. Yes. You and I have had a discussion before now about the meet the speaker opportunities at conferences and how you name those and what does that name mean. And I know that I've always said to you, I'm more comfortable saying that I'll host a couch session. And actually, I feel in that context, my role is to try and go into the background to get everybody else talking and then to be able to almost make myself invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Whereas when you run something, you run the genius bar, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And I can see a lot of merit in that because I think a lot of the people who come to speak at the conferences have such a lot to offer and people do want to go and hear from them. Now, this is my problem. What are your ideas for solving it? But I would be so uncomfortable to be called a genius because I don't feel that's how I help people. I feel like mm-hmm. it's what you've just said. It's the discussion. It's the thinking about. It's listening to several people and then understanding that you're allowed to pick what you want, that you don't have to take one person's view.
Right. It's being the expert versus being a facilitator.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I drew something about this idea, Isabel, where I just drew like a kind of stick figures and two mountains. And I put a person up the same thing, person at the top of each. And at the top of one, I wrote, you know, everybody can see me. When at the other, I wrote, I can see everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if that's the same idea, and one can seem incredibly intimidating and the other one can seem very personable, those two mentalities. And it's true, just changing the words, mm-hmm. the way we title something changes the behavior in which people interact with the concept. Yes. Not only the person, quote unquote, leading or facilitating, but also the way people behave or show up.
And I think as well that it depends on the person. There are people who are geniuses, who are people to listen to, who will always, not always, but will have good ideas, who are teachers in that sense. And mm-hmm. then there are those of us who are in a different place. So it's mm-hmm. knowing where you are and being comfortable with that is important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a difference between someone being an expert and being a guru, right? Mm-hmm. The guru is, when people guruize people, they listen to every word that comes out of their mouth and treat it as if it's gold.
Mm-hmm.
And then the reality of being an expert is you have a lot of valuable stuff to give. But people, if they view themselves, it's sort of like that, viewing yourselves as having a critically thinking mind, mm-hmm. then you're not just going to take everything and treat it as gold, right? You're going to listen to it critically.
Well, so you have something to learn too. As like, to me, an expert is also somebody who has something to learn.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And this fits in also with, you mentioned the Star Canada talk, and one of the things in there is I talk about leadership and followership. We talk an awful lot about leadership models and what does the leader do and what's the leader, and it focuses it all around the leader. So even when people are talking about collaborative activities, they'll still be talking about leadership. But actually, I came across on the internet, and I now can't remember the reference, but it's in the talk that I give. This idea of followership. So actually, what are the models for followership? And this idea that you can be very passive or very active as a follower. So you can be the type of follower that's always got to be pushed into doing the next thing and constantly directed.
Uh-huh.
Or you can be the sort of follower who, on being asked to do something, is sort of very busy the whole time. And that was sort of like one dimension for measuring followership. Where do you want to be on that? And what's the most useful place from your leader's point of view? And then on the other dimension, he measures the idea of how passive or critical your thinking is. So you can have people who are followers who are very passive in their thinking and they'll just accept whatever they're given. And you can have people who are very critical in their thinking and will question it.
Mm-hmm.
What he was saying, he says, is if you put that into a quadrant, down in the bottom quadrant, you've got people inactive and passive thinkers. And basically, it's sort of like having a herd of sheep, although I have to say sheep can be quite stroppy. You've got a group of people there, and they're only going to do things when they're asked to do them, and they're going to do exactly what they're asked to do.
Yes.
It's of no use to the leader because they're going to end up doing things that possibly aren't useful. But if you take people who are passive and only do things when they're told to do them and are also very critical, it's incredibly negative for the team and for the leader, because you've got people who are constantly pointing out what's wrong but not doing anything about it.
Right.
And on the other hand, if you've got people who are incredibly active and busy but don't question anything, they're producing a shed load of work at high speed, but it's not necessarily of any use. And so he's actually saying, actually, what we need to be is busy and active and engaged and self-starting, but also critical of our leaders. So if you take that from the leadership point of view, you have to be looking for people in your team who are going to be critical to you, because they're being critical in order to make the situation better.
Wow.
And so actually that was a really powerful message for me. And it made me think about some of the situations I've been in where I've been in a meeting perhaps, and I've been trying to suggest a new way of doing things. You know, maybe I've been called in to do some process improvement or some such thing like that. And I've realized that the people who sit in the meeting and nod and say yes aren't necessarily my supporters. Mm. They're just doing that for the sake of the meeting. But the people who sit in the meeting and say, that's not going to work because, or we've tried before and this happens, are not actually being negative. They're actually being helpful.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a hard thing for leaders to learn too. I try to say to the people that I work with, I'm always up for a good debate.
Mm.
So, and it's hard sometimes to teach people that because they're naturally afraid of you as the boss or the leader. But I try to sort of say, if you want to, I sort of get a great deal of respect for the people that come with a good argument to say, no, I really want to do this because X, Y, Z. And I'm like, okay, great. You know, as long as it makes sense, I actually prefer to have people on my team that are like that. But it's difficult to get people to do that without feeling that they're under threat or they're whatever, you know. So it's a hard balance.
Yeah.
So I want to talk for a minute about your failure and recovery talk that you did at Women Who Test, because that was incredible. I mean, people like gave you a standing ovation and they were like tearing up eyes in the audience because it was such a moving talk. And can you talk a little bit about failure and recovery and how that sort of changed and shaped your path in life?
Oh, gosh. It's quite difficult to talk about while being recorded. It's interesting because when I talk about those things at a conference, it tends to be in a closed room. And I tend to be saying to people, I'd rather you didn't tweet about this. I'd rather you didn't share it.
True.
But
yes.
I think, you know, my life has been full of ups and downs, quite a roller coaster in all sorts of different ways. And what I've come to realize is that the low parts in it, when it looks like things are going wrong, it's very often an opportunity for rethinking one's life in quite a radical way. And also, the points where I'm coming out of those low points, I'm often very, very productive creatively.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about being taken to a point in your being where physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, whatever the reasons, environmental, all sorts of different reasons, being taken to a point of nothingness gives you somewhere to build from, which is sort of scary, but it almost can be less scary than being at the top of the high. So I don't mean that just in, say, emotional transaction. I remember winning a Best Paper Award at Eurostar a few years ago, and it was wonderful, and I was really pleased to have won it, and it's a lovely award which I treasure. But I was talking to somebody who'd won it a previous year, and we were going, oh God, so what do we do next? It's like, where do you go now? So it's like, once you've got up, you were talking, Jesse, about being at the top of the mountain, and another thing about that is when you get to the top of the mountain, you go, I'm at the top of the mountain, or do you go, oh, look, look, I'm just at the top of a foothill and there's another mountain?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So I've skirted around some of a lot of the detail in there that I'd perhaps talk about if I was doing this talk. You've kindly asked me to do it again at Star East, which is in itself a cause for a panic, because I'm now going, well, it might not come out in the same way.
I have a question for you, Isabel. And of course, if you don't want to answer it, you don't have to. But you said that when it causes you to kind of rethink in a radical, creative way, can you share kind of in what way it has you become creative? Like, what kind of creativity?
Okay, so a variety of things. For example, I tend to start writing poetry or painting or making art quilts, and I'll get a burst of energy towards that sort of area. It'll make me try new things, which perhaps I haven't tried before. Mm-hmm. In terms of, I'm doing a research program at the moment, and going on to that came out of being in quite a low place. And then as I came out of it, suddenly getting a burst of energy where I thought I can do anything. Mm. And I think it's the contrast between the I can do nothing through to the realization that you can. And then suddenly something, a switch goes. You go, well, actually, if I can do this, then I can do anything I want.
Yeah.
Right.
A silly example is one year at our East, Doc Graham persuaded me to go on a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And I'd never been on a roller coaster because I knew that I would hate it. But she persuaded me to try it, and I did hate it. It was absolutely one of the most vile. Oh, my God. So we did it three times. We went on three rides.
Just to make sure, absolutely sure, you hated it.
Yeah, absolutely. Will this one be any better? No, I do not like the upside down. I had my eyes closed the whole way. Every time I tried to open my eyes, something appalling was happening. But actually, it's like you get off and you go, well, you know, I'm still alive.
Right.
And I've done that. So if I can do that, then probably I can try all sorts of other things that I might not have tried. Mm-hmm. The first one we went on was the SeaWorld Mantra, where they actually hang you upside down.
Oh my god!
I've been on that.
I said to the guy who was to the attendant, I said, "I've never been on a roller coaster before. Is it going to be all right? Am I going to fall out? Will you strap me in tightly?" And he came and he just looked at me and he just went, "Okay." And he really tied the. I could not move at all.
He's like, I'm not letting this lady down here.
But you could see he was just thinking she shouldn't be on here.
So, oh my God.
It's so crazy. I have a similar loathing for roller coasters. And every now and then, every 10, 20 years, I try that again. And I loathe it equally as much. And now they take horrifying pictures of you as you're going through the experience.
At your low point of life. Just so you can remember
There is a picture, and there's some guy I don't know who's on the third seat with this rapturous expression on his face, and Doc with this rapturous expression on her face, and me just like with my eyes closed and my head down and my fists clenched. I'm just like, make this stop. Just make this stop now.
Yes, yes. Yes.
You could put it in mixed media painting or something. I don't know. You could make it into something lovely. I'm here for you.
My first roller coaster experience was in Australia when I was a teenager. And, you know, my friends were like all about the roller coasters, and they were old wooden roller coasters in those days. And I was like, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. Well, it turned out I was going with a group of boys and girls, and this boy I really liked was going. And so I sort of psyched myself up. I'm like, okay, I'm doing this. I'm doing this. I'm doing this. And I psyched myself up. And then we all met up for the train and to get the train into the city to go to this experience. And then when we got there, they said, oh, Richard's in the hospital with a nosebleed. He's not coming this morning. And I was like, oh. So there was all these couples and me. But because I'd psyched myself up so much for the Big Dipper, as it was called, when we got there, I actually went through with it. But I went through it with a stranger because I didn't have a person to sit next to. And so here I am, this teenage girl gripping the heck out of some sort of 50-year-old man's arm, like, and he had fingernail claws in his arms. And I screamed the whole time, I want to get off. I want to get off.
Was he actually kind to you?
Yeah, he was. He was a little stunned, but very kind.
Oh, no. My favorite story is my friend was a magician at the Busch Gardens in Tampa, and he was doing a juggling act, and somebody's prosthetic limb flew off into his juggling act.
Oh, my God.
And it flew into his act. And, like, you're not supposed to go on a roller coaster if you have any of these prosthetic limb or heart condition. So I don't think he read the memo. But anyway, can you imagine you're doing a magic act and somebody's limb goes flying into your juggling act?
That's appalling and wonderful at the same time, isn't it?
Yes, it's awful and magical at the same time. Life can be lovely and horrific. Exact same time.
That's a crazy story, Jess.
Yeah.
You have to laugh so you don't cry. Exactly.
I mean, is it the person on the roller coaster? What was it like for them as well? And actually, the attendants for the roller coaster. And furthermore, anybody who saw that limb flying through the air would not have known it was prosthetic.
The trauma for the rest of their lives, having to go find the leg and then returning it. I mean, just the horror of the whole.
Well, and then it's expensive, and did it get damaged? I mean,
there's just so many unknowns.
Yeah. Oh my God, that is crazy.
Oh, geez.
So now that we're laughing, I want to tell you one of the things that I absolutely love about Isabel is, Isabel, you do take on challenges that make you uncomfortable on a regular basis. And we just need to, we'll talk about your stage fright, because I want you to sort of explain to people what goes on for you, because you're truly amazing when you show up on stage, but there is a tremendous amount that goes on inside of you before you do that. And then I just want to mention that you actually asked me if you could do stand-up comedy at a couple of Women Who Test, because you wanted to take on this challenge of being sort of really uncomfortable and doing this. And you were, like, hilariously funny. So tell everybody what motivates you to do that sort of stuff, and then how, what goes on inside of your head when you're planning to do that stuff.
The stand-up comedy stuff, I'm going to implicate Tanya Katan in this.
You should always implicate Tanya Katan.
Yes.
I was talking with her one day, and I'd been doing a writing workshop with her, and people were finding my writing very funny. And the beginning of the sessions doing this, I had the same sensation that I'd always had, which is that all through my life, people have laughed at me, and I've assumed that it's because I'm stupid and ludicrous, but I've never understood what the joke is. So during this writing workshop sequence, I was trying to pick out from other people, what is it that you're laughing at? And in the end, I had this conversation with Tanya about it, and she said, well, you're so funny, and there's the timing and the way you tell the stories and the way you write about them is just very funny. And people aren't laughing at me. They're laughing because they think I've just made a joke. So I started turning that around in my head and thinking, well, in that case, could I actually deliberately make the jokes and see if people laugh at them? I talked to Tanya about the idea of doing stand-up, and she said, the Women Who Test could possibly be the kindest audience you could ever get, so try it there, ask Alison. So that's why I got hold of you, and indeed that has proved to be the case. But so I've stumbled through two stand-up sessions at Women Who Test, and actually the failure talk that you mentioned earlier, Tanya said to me after that, it was very like a piece of stand-up with PowerPoint slides. So I feel like I've demonstrated that there are still times when I'm not quite sure why people are finding it funny, but I'm accepting that that laughter and applause is actually very positive. And this is people sort of going through the journey with me of whatever it is. And that one in Canada, I talked, didn't I, about the series of accidents that I'd had in the week leading up to doing that talk, one of which was that you'd come to speak to me over breakfast to ask me something about what I was doing in the conference. And I'd been eating a piece of watermelon, which I then managed to inhale instead of eating, so it was stuck in my trachea. And I was just describing the completely ridiculous thought processes I was going through, where, you know, and at one point I was thinking, how do I get rid of this? I'm going to have to stick it up, but I don't want to be sick on Alison. I'd rather be dead. It's ridiculous. And so it's actually, I guess what I'm doing is, for me, a little bit with that, I'm exploring, what is it that other people are seeing about me that I can't see? And why is that a positive thing? Because I didn't realize it was.
Well, also too, you're sharing the inner monologues that a lot of people have with themselves that they don't share out with.
Yes. And you're so good at it. Like, I think it's so relatable. Yeah, it's so relatable. And the way that you deliver it, your timing is really good. And your way of putting words together is really good. And I don't know. You're such a good storyteller.
You are, which actually brings me, because I know we're going to play a game in a minute, Jesse, and I really want to, Isabel, you talk about storytelling and how important it is. And can you tell us just a little bit about how you use storytelling, why you think it's important for people to use in their jobs, and sort of what the elements are of telling a good story?
Okay. I suppose one of the reasons it's important goes back to the previous question you asked me, which was about the stage fright, which is, if you can find a way to talk that slightly distances you from the message you're giving, it's like there's a formality actually in that I'm now telling you a story. You can actually manage things like stage fright or meeting fright or whatever else you get. So you go in thinking, here's the story I'm going to tell, and I'm going to tell it in this way. And you've rehearsed it. And so instead of just trying to be ad hoc, you're giving yourself the chance to think in advance about what it is you want to say. So that's one of the ways I think that storytelling is very important, particularly for software testers who I've frequently seen in meetings not quite knowing how to put their message across. There's some really important things to say, perhaps after you've done a piece of testing, that you want people to listen to. And it's possible to bury those under statistics, not having thought about what you want to say, and so on and so forth. And then the other part of that, particularly in the work context, is the listening part of it. So if you're listening to what other people are doing, how they're reacting, what they're interposing, and you weave that into the story you're telling, you engage that audience more. So in terms of how we interact with other people at work, I think particularly for those of us who are more prone to stage fright, nervousness, don't like to speak, the act of thinking of it as what is the story I want to tell at this meeting? What is it I want people to listen to? What do I need to listen to from them in order to add it to my story? That it's those sorts of things that are important. And if you have those, if you have that idea of storytelling, you can then start bringing into it analogy and metaphor and fable and anecdote and tradition. So maybe within the group you're working with, there are things that have happened before. So just like in a society, we have a legend about, oh, you know, Santa Claus comes and puts presents down the chimney and this is how it happens. In an organization, you could have a similar sort of legend, if you like, a fable, or in the case of Santa Claus, as we know for the under 10s listening, the truth. We always do things in. So, do you remember on that other project that this thing happened? Do you remember when Jeff did that during this piece of programming or during that piece of testing? And then such and such a thing happened and Jane did so and so. We don't want that to happen again, or let's try and do that again. So I think it's that sort of, it's a whole mix of the different things that in society we use storytelling for. We can bring them to work and use those ideas of myth and legend and, you know, family history and anecdote and metaphor and weave them together. So we're not just giving people tedious facts. We're making a surround for it that makes it easy for them to take the information in and to respond to it.
Yeah, that's really awesome. I think that people don't often think about what story they're trying to tell and what the outcome that they're trying to elicit sometimes. And you tend to sort of go in as a bit of a blank state with a whole lot of sort of emotional biases a lot of the time, don't you?
Yeah. And in the same way, I mean, again, thinking about Tanya and her craft and what she does, like the preparation for a performance and the rehearsal for a performance and thinking about what might happen and how you deal with it. And Jesse, for you, with doing improv, I mean, it always feels to me that although improv sounds as though we're just making this up on the spur of the moment, you'd actually be doing quite a lot of preparation in advance.
Yeah, so what we prep is the framework, and we also prep the knowing of the team. Yeah. So we know so much about each other's stories, each other's behaviors, likes, dislikes, what we're good at, what we're bad at. And so that way it's unscripted, but we have all of that knowledge to play around with in the moment. Yeah. So that's the way we're rehearsed.
Yeah. So my analogy for that would be a development manager I used to work with a number of years ago, and we'd go across together to the fortnightly management meetings. And before we went across, we'd sit together and we'd be saying, what do you think so-and-so is going to be talking about? What do you think they're going to try and, what are they going to want to get from us this week? What are they going to come and complain about? Yeah, what's going to be the thing that we're going to need to stand together on? We were making a framework. We didn't know exactly what was going to happen. Sometimes we'd prep and none of those things would happen and something else would come up. But the fact that we'd sat and thought about the story we wanted to take to the meeting, and really importantly, that together. It wasn't like we'd gone separately with a test and a development story. We'd gone jointly with a story.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I really love the idea, too, about a metaphor legend that you all have in common, that shared experience, that shared narrative that you could talk about. Mm. So would you like to play a game? What do you think? Oh. You're like, nope.
No, you just have to stage fright a bit for it. Let's go for it.
I won't make it on a roller coaster, I promise.
Because if you did, it's like,
goodbye. I'm going to claw your arm. And So what if we did a storytelling game? Mm-hmm. Did it one word at a time. So basically, we'll go around so we could say, so I could start and then it could go me, Allison, Isabel, me, Allison, Isabel. And we're just adding one word at a time, trying to tell a very simple story. So the idea is that, again, we're keeping it as simple as possible so that we can follow each other's words, right? And through line, because we don't want to make it complicated because that will throw each other off.
Right.
And then we're just going to try and make it have a simple beginning, middle, and end.
That's good. I like this idea because I've seen this game played where your role is to try and trip up the next player, but we're actually doing the reverse. We're trying to support each other.
We're trying to support each other. And so that in the end, because we're simple, we will try and be as successful as possible together.
Brilliant.
So I will start, and then Allison, then Isabel, and back to me. Okay?
Yep.
So once
upon
time
lived
there
a
beautiful
horse
named
Fantasy,
who
loved
gallop
to the
fields.
Fantasy
was
black
with
a
long
white
tail,
and
he
loved
rolling
around
in
the
mud
on
his
backside.
Then
Jane
the
rider
said,
get
up.
You
silly
muddy
horse.
Or
you
will
be
dirty
all
day
long.
And
fantasy
didn't.
So
fantasy
just
neighed.
Yeah. Yay. Oh, that was really good.
Fantasy, the stubborn black and white horse.
Yes.
Like, I'm not having it. I'm rolling around in the mud and I really don't care what you have to say.
I'm just going to neigh all day.
Hashtag neigh away.
Do you know, that was weird because did you find that you choose a word thinking it's obvious what comes next?
Yes,
I
did.
And then something completely different would happen.
Yes, absolutely. I think I would be teeing you up for something and then I'd be like, oh, that's so much better. Oh, yeah, oh, that's so different. That's awesome.
Yeah, ditto.
Nice.
Very good.
You did a wonderful job. And yeah, that's the idea, is that it's different when you're storytelling and building something collaboratively with each other, that when you have the ability to do it on your own is one thing, but when you're working together, you can be delighted and surprised at where people take things. And if you're open and listening and you're open to not like forcing an agenda to go in one way, and you know that the people you're working with really truly support whatever you put out there and they're going to back you up, then what's pleasant in the end. And even if you make a mistake, they still have your back.
Yeah.
So I thought we did great. We kept it simple and fun. And
yeah. Here's to being delighted and surprised every day.
Yes, exactly. 2019.
So speaking of 2019, at this part in our journey, we usually like to get our guests to tell us what's coming up next for them this year.
Right.
Is there something you want to talk about?
Okay, well, I mentioned earlier I'm doing a bit of research, and for all sorts of personal and work reasons, that's been very up and down. I'm hoping to concentrate on that. No, not hoping. I will concentrate on that this year. So I'm going to be doing a lot of reading and writing around the area of the user experience of test tools. And at the moment, I'm working with my supervisors, Dr. Porter and Dr. Micklef at University of Malta, who are advising me on taking my 20 million ideas and making them down into one thing I can actually complete instead of flapping around. So that's going to take a certain amount of time. And my other big thing this year is I'm the Eurostar Conference 2019 program chair, which is a huge honor. And it's going to be hard work. We're already working on the program. That takes place in November. And a lot of this year will be spent trying to make that as good a conference as I can. We've got a theme of working well, which is very broad, and getting people to send in submissions to speak under that title. And I've worked with them to, we're going to introduce and trial a new idea. One of the things that you and I have talked about a lot, Alison, is getting new people speaking and getting women to speak and so on, and getting more people to apply the sort of flying for tracks level and bringing people on. The next stage on from that, which is how do you become a keynote? So I've talked with the Eurostar team about holding a slot open for what we're calling new generation keynotes. And what we're going to do is select people to do not a full 45-minute keynote, but 15 minutes. People who've never done a keynote before, but have scored well in as track speakers. And I'm very excited about that. We're going to get them mentoring by somebody who's a keynote speaker, not myself, but somebody else, who will help them move from being a track speaker to being able to present at that plenary keynote, big conference level. So that's a sort of a big thing this year, is putting that program together, selecting the tutorials, selecting the keynotes, selecting the whole program, and this idea is the new generation keynotes.
That's wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show with us today. Really appreciate it. So much fun.
Well, thank you for having me. it's been good fun and not nearly as nerve-wracking once we got going as I thought it was going to be. So it's been good fun. Always lovely to talk to you both.
Yes, I love this. I say that one of the reasons that I do this work is because I get to hang out with so many amazing women, and I find over the years, if I've introduced these key people in my life to each other, they always seem to mesh together just perfectly. And it's like I have this whole other, I'm calling it my female family. I have this whole other group of women that are just so fabulous. And Isabel, you are definitely in my female family. So thank you for being here today.
I'm very, very happy to be there. And I just have to say, you know, what you've done with Women Who Test is extraordinary. And it has been life-changing for me. It really has. You know, it's been really important. So thank you for having me. I'm honored to be part of this journey we're all on.
Thanks. Thanks. Right back at you, as they say in America. Thanks, Isabel.
Thanks. Bye.
Wasn't it great talking to Isabel? She's so fantastic. She's really unassuming. And then all of a sudden, she just comes out with all these incredible insights. What were some of your favorite parts, Allison?
I loved everything about what Isabel had to say today. I know, seriously, she's just so wise. But I loved the stuff that she had to say about failure and recovery. I think it's so important that we all learn from our failures. And I love the way she talked about how sometimes when you're at your lowest point, it can actually be the point of most inspiration. And that when people do get to their lowest point, that's the time that they radically and creatively rethink their life. And she gave that amazing example about her roller coaster ride in Orlando, which was amazing.
She went on 3 times.
I know, right?
That was great.
I also love what she has to say about storytelling. Storytelling is such an art form, and she is so brilliant at it. And I loved how she laid out the different aspects of storytelling and how important it is to think of your audience, and not just when you're on stage, but when you're in a meeting and when you have stage fright or meeting fright, as she called it, when you want to talk to your peers or when you want to get a message across, how you always really should be thinking about the story that you're going to tell, the objective that you have in mind at the end. So those were the things that stood out for me. What about you?
So I also loved the piece about story. The other thing that really stuck out was talking about the people on your team. I think sometimes we're reassured when we are looking around in a meeting and seeing these people that sort of are the yes men or the yes women. They're just sort of nodding their heads like a bobblehead. But what she talked about is actually the people that are critical, that are challenging you and doing it in a way to give you feedback and are staying curious and helping you. Those are the people that could be the most impactful. So let's take a listen to that little nugget that she talks about again.
You have to be looking for people in your team who are going to be critical to you, because they're being critical in order to make the situation better. And so actually, that was a really powerful message for me. And it made me think about some of the situations I've been in where I've been in a meeting, perhaps, and I've been trying to suggest a new way of doing things. You know, maybe I've been called in to do some process improvement or some such thing like that. And I've realized that the people who sit in the meeting and nod and say yes aren't necessarily my supporters. They're just doing that for the sake of the meeting. But the people who sit in the meeting and say, that's not going to work because, or we've tried before and this happens, are not actually being negative. They're actually being helpful.
You've been listening to Women Who Change Tech, the podcast that connects you to extraordinary women for deep, inspiring conversations.